Welcome to Syntax. In this Wednesday, I was trying to do the West voice. In this Wednesday, we're going to be doing a potluck, and we're going to be doing it a little bit differently today because Wes is out of the office, OOTO. So we have CJ filling in for Wes, and we're going to be doing a potluck for y'all. We have a ton of great questions. We're going to be diving into all kinds of things, like what kind of books we like, what kind of podcasts we like. But not only that, we're getting into technical stuff. We're going to be talking about, perhaps Vue.js. We're going to be talking about skills for basic developers, like what are the base level foundational skills you should be learning and stuff about your home office. So with me, as not always, but for the first time in a regular episode, is CJ. CJ, what's up, dude?
Hello. Not much. I'm doing all right. I've got some big Canadian shoes to fill today. So I'm gonna do my best, A.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah. I love it. I know this is a Canadian podcast, after all, as Wes.
Well,
like
I mean,
to
today
say.
Rocky Mountain podcast.
Yes, this is a Mile High podcast. Which I gotta say, man, we've been getting a lot. We get a lot of sun in Denver. 300+ days of sun a year. Not to brag, but it is sunny. It's been sunny and lovely here. So
yeah.
Feeling the vibes. And if you're feeling the vibes, you might not be hitting the bugs and errors that you might be having in your code. But sometimes that's not always how it goes. And your code is a little cloudy. And if your code is cloudy, then you're going to want to have something like Sentry to have your back, because that's truly what it does. It has your back. It helps you solve errors. It helps you solve performance issues. It helps you solve all kinds of things. It found slow database queries for us. It's done so much for us. So if you want to check out Sentry, head on over to sentry.io/syntax. Sign up and get 2 months for free. CJ, I once had a client of mine tell me that the design that I had designed felt cloudy and that he needed it to feel more sunny. And I was like, that was great. I have no idea what the hell that means. So,
okay. Yeah, me neither. No idea.
Classic client stuff, right?
Right.
So let's get into the first question. First question here from Robbie. What book changed your life? Do you have any books that you really enjoyed, CJ?
This is probably the worst question for me. I left it on there because I think you have some good answers, but I actually don't read a lot of books. And I think like my answer for this is if I can't get past the first chapter, I just stop reading it. So like there's nothing, yeah. There hasn't really been anything that hasn't changed my life. But I listen to like a lot of like science fiction on like audiobooks and stuff like that. Right now I'm actually listening to The Three Body Problem.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Haven't finished it yet, but it is fascinating. But yeah.
I'm interested in that.
That's my main thing is, yeah, if I'm not interested, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I feel that. I don't get into too much fiction as much as when I do, I like it. Like I don't read anything. I just listen. I listen to The Martian and I really like that. Or stuff like that. You know, I can get into it. What was it? There were some fantasy books by a really prolific author, Stormlight Chronicles or something. I think that's called what it's called. I got into those really, really a lot for a little bit. But for the most part, I stick to nonfiction stuff. And books that I actually did read are like kind of picture-y books, because I'm a child, apparently. there's these two, Whatever You Think the Opposite, and It's Not How Good You Are, It's How Good You Want to Be. These are like really thought-provoking books. They're very graphical, so like big graphic text to illustrate a point on each page, and they're brilliant books. Like they're just like micro points in them. Like everybody had done the high jump one way until one guy decided to do it this really weird way, and now that's how everybody does it. But illustrated in a fun way to just kind of get your brain into like different headspace. And those are two books. I think my dad bought me one of them. Whatever You Think the Opposite, I think, as a like a Christmas gift one year. And I was just like, holy cow, this is great. A book that Ben Vinegar recommended to me when I started at Syntax was Crucial Conversations. And it's kind of a cliche book, but it has really changed how I approach heavy, or not even heavy, but like important conversations in my life. So whether that is conversations with, family or conversations with coworkers or whatever, I got a lot of value out of this book. And there's a lot of like stories from, influential people who have like been in meetings with Tim Cook. And it's like, oh, okay. That is a whole world. So yeah, really interesting books.
Nice. Yeah, so this next one comes from Electric Ellie, and their question is, what are the fundamental web app development principles that beginners should know about when starting web app development? And they have in their list authentication, test-driven development, deployment. Honestly, I don't think any of those things are at the top of my list for beginners. There's actually a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think is most important is like really understanding the client-server model. I come across so many beginners that just like don't really understand the difference between the client side and the server side. And being able to differentiate those, even if you don't do a lot of backend development, is huge, especially if you're working on a team that has backend developers, because you can at least better understand what their piece of the puzzle is. And then along those same lines is understanding that same security model of backend versus frontend, because when you're working in frontend code, that code gets shipped to the browser. So there's only certain things you should do within that code, because at the end of the day, end users can technically look at the source code and see what's happening in there. So really understanding what's happening where, I think, is one of the most important things.
Yeah, I have that as a big one too. Understanding the client and the server, but not like how you don't necessarily have to even write client or server side code, right? Because that can be a whole can of worms in itself. But just like simply understanding its role, like you said, is like, that's a big deal, right?
Yeah. And then another one I have is CLI basics. So I know there are like GUI tools for like Git and stuff like that, but especially in more modern front end web development, you're going to come across a lot of build tools and scripts and things you have to run. So just being somewhat comfortable with the command line, I think, is pretty important. So just like basic commands like cd and ls and those kinds of things, because you're going to be running Node and NPM scripts and like maybe like a Vite build process or something like that. So yeah, that's definitely at the top of my list as well.
Yeah. If you want to learn some of that, Wes has a free course, Command Line Power User. There's also, I did a course a long time ago on the syntax, well, it was Level Up tutorials at the time, but it's on the YouTube channel if you're watching on YouTube. So,
and then another one I have that almost has like kind of like nothing to do with like writing code itself is really just working on your workflow and how you work. So I'm a big proponent of like keyboard shortcuts and just like working efficiently. I think that's definitely something you should look at, like, especially if you're trying to mix things up when you're a beginner and you're learning, is like, you don't want to just be writing code all the time. You can focus on your setup, focus on memorizing keyboard shortcuts, also like work on your work habits of like actually working for a little bit, taking breaks. Maybe you can try Pomodoros, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with all that stuff. And in fact, like the only things that I would add on top of there, I think you mentioned like CLI tools to use like Git. But I do think, you know, Git is one of those things that like, I remember like seeing Git commands for the first time and being like, holy cow. I know Randy can probably relate to this because he had to learn Git stuff kind of as a non-developer. I'd been working as a developer and Git still confused the hell out of me. So yeah, Git and GitHub, understanding like how to host stuff, even for like the most basic. I remember dragging and dropping stuff on an FTP and then realizing, okay, if you know, an index.html file is loaded from this directory, how does that all work? And obviously the app development has changed substantially since then, but yeah, totally. Yeah, I totally agree on all that stuff. Also, CSS, HTML. Yeah, you can get a long way just by learning CSS and HTML. Obviously, JavaScript and JavaScript frameworks become a big thing in our industry nowadays. But hey, you can't beat learning CSS and HTML, especially nowadays. Next question here is from Seven Steven. Pronunciation, actually the way it looks, just not Steven. My wife hates that. Steven, you told us to say Steven, and I know you did that on purpose. next one, the question here is, what are your thoughts on Chris Coyer's post on his sale of CSS tricks and what has happened? Yeah, I got a lot of thoughts here. You know, I have a little personal story. There was an acquisition attempt to Level Up Tutorials a long time ago, and the vibes were bad. The money was bad. Everything was bad. And I'm so thankful I turned it down after seeing what happened here. Because for a little while, I was like, was that right of me to turn that down? You know, as you're seeing, maybe the pandemic happened, subscriber numbers are like a roller coaster. You're really stressed out one week to the next week, whatever. You're like, man, was that the right idea? Should I have just taken some cash and run? But seeing as how this all played out, I am thankful that I chose not to do that at that time, especially given the relationship that we have with Sentry through that acquisition, right? So my thoughts are, man, it sucks. I love CSS Tricks. CSS Tricks is like my favorite thing forever and ever and ever. Chris was, you know, a huge inspiration of mine for, you know, getting started. And when I first got to meet him, it was like, oh man, Chris is the man. So I was really bummed out to read that. And I feel like, you know, the DigitalOcean folks are now saying that they're going to work with Chris. That's like the new update to this since this has come out. So Chris wrote this blog post. We'll have it in the show notes. I highly encourage you to read it. But they've since come out and said, you know, we're working with Chris to get CSS Tricks back up to some capacity. I just wish it would have never happened in the first place. And I used to be a fan of DigitalOcean. And the way that they handled this, no thanks, man. Even if they bring CSS Tricks back, I'll support CSS Tricks, but I'm not about to give DigitalOcean a ton of support. So that's kind of how I feel about it. I'm a little salty about it.
Yeah. I don't have much insight more than really just like reading the blog post recently and kind of like seeing Chris's perspective on everything. But that's kind of my take on it. It was like, this just sucks because like CSS Tricks was awesome. Like it was the definitive resource for like so many things. Like anytime I wanted to know about Flexbox or CSS Grid, like I would go to CSS Tricks for that. So it's really sad to hear the story of DigitalOcean kind of taking over and not really doing much with it.
Yeah, and it was really hard for us too when we announced that Syntax was getting acquired by Sentry. I think rightfully people were concerned. They were very concerned that this was going to be another CSS Tricks, which obviously it hasn't been. But I think Sentry was cognizant of that. They were like, we need to make sure that we are assuring people that this is not that. We're going to take the thing that you like and make it way better by adding CJ and Randy. So, yeah, and video and all the cool stuff that they've allowed us to do. So, you know, yeah, it stinks all around. Not a whole lot there to it.
Yeah. All right. This next question comes from Mike, and it is, what advice would you give to someone finally looking to migrate an existing React project over to TypeScript? Any gotchas to keep an eye out for? Any linting tools to take advantage of? Should the work be done in a feature branch solely dedicated to the migration, or can it be done in a more piecemeal manner? Any other advice? Thanks. So I'll give my perspective on it first. And I think it depends on the size of the project and also like the number of people on the project. I would say if it's like a really big project that you can't just kind of like do all in one go, one of the easiest things to do is just start one file at a time. So one of the cool things about like even like working inside of VS Code is you can get TypeScript support even inside of JavaScript files. So one of the first things you could do is just put a / TS -check at the top of any JavaScript file. And then you're going to start to get some type hints inside of that file. And then from there, you can start to change the file. So like go one file at a time, and you can basically make it so that like if you're working on a specific feature, now's the time to also convert it over to TypeScript, kind of like make it your process of any new feature, also make sure that you're shipping TypeScript code with it. So swap a JS file to a TS file or a JSX file to a TSX file, and then gradually fix the errors within that one feature, within that one file. And I would also say that when you're early on in this process, keep your TS config settings like way less strict. So you should actually allow the anytype and allow things like TS ignore and TS expect error. Because you're going to have an easier time of converting. Now, obviously, you want to get to a point where you have like a stricter configuration and like you're really like writing the best TypeScript you can. But early on, you definitely want to be a little bit less strict so that you can make bigger strides in terms of like converting your code base.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. I did this. I converted a code base. Believe it or not, I converted a code base. That's something I unfortunately have done way too many times in my life. I converted a code base from Meteor to this, the same code base from Meteor to React, from React class components to React function components with hooks to then Svelte, same code base. And at some point in there, I converted it from React to React via TypeScript. So I've had a lot of experience converting a big code base, which I probably could have been way more productive than doing that. But TypeScript, for me, make a branch and go for it, right? Dedicate, you can like, depending on how big your code base is, the level up code base was big, but you can make a substantial move there in the course of a week, depending on how many people are working on it. Even if it's just one person, if you grind on it, you can grind on it and make some real progress. You can do things piecemeal. Like you said, CJ, you don't have to have 100% TS completion. Like, For instance, I don't think level up tutorials, even after we converted to TypeScript, I don't think it had 100% TS free errors for even like a year after that, because for the large part, like TypeScript is there to help you. And if you can see that, okay, I have these following TypeScript errors, and instead of just tossing an any on it and letting it go, I'm just going to leave those errors and still build the site without passing it through like TypeScript. I'm going to use TypeScript essentially as a linter, right?
Yeah.
And it will find issues on any new components you make, and it's going to do this kind of things. Now, the advice I can give on actually doing the conversion beyond just doing it piecemeal is that start at the root, start at the data, because if you start at the leaves, if you start at the end, by the time you get to the roots where you have the data loading, you're going to be just having a mishmash of types and everything. But if you get your types all set up from the root where the data starts and then branch out from there, that is how I found it to be the most effective. Start with how the data is being loaded, what that data structure looks like, and then as you go, that will help you get further into your leaf components. It also makes it easier to kind of reason about, right? You can start at your main layouts and stuff. But there will be a time when there's a lot of red squigglies. Like I've like, you know, 1,000 TypeScript errors, and you're just like, all right, great, let's go, you know? And many of those can be chomped down with one fell swoop. You add one type in, and, you know, stuff really propagates. But be prepared for some tears, go for it. And don't, if your application works, don't stress about that TypeScript error number being zero.
Definitely. I completely agree with, I mean, like so many people can get too caught up in like fixing all of the errors and too caught up in like trying to make like the perfect TypeScript code base. But like you said, it really is at its core kind of just a linter. Like it's going to help you with a lot of problems. And I completely agree with data first, because honestly, that's where you're going to get most of the benefit, right? If you start describing your types and your objects, that's going to flow through your code base. And now you have a bunch of different places where you can like catch little errors like, oh, well, you made a typo on a property name, or, oh, this object is actually missing properties that were required. So yeah, I completely agree. Data first is a great approach. And just go for it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because we talked a little bit about this. I had a TikTok. It was from a clip from one of the episodes of Syntax where it was like, we launched with TypeScript errors for the new Syntax site. And that was like, I don't know if people think you can't do that, but we did that and it's fine. It's like we tested the website, you know, just because TypeScript says that there's a problem doesn't mean that there's a problem. Right. But then there was a lot of comments that were like, man, you got to be a noob to not be able to get all the types, you know, if you can't fix up. But that's not how it works, man. Sometimes TypeScript, if you haven't like used TypeScript in a complex project, sometimes there are just types that are really hard to wrangle in. You know, it's not all the time, but there's sometimes, like, for instance, we had a caching mechanism that was like pretty custom, where what it was doing, it was accepting the query parameters for a Prisma query. It was accepting what type of query that was. So we're doing like a find mini or whatever. And then it's accepting like a cache time sort of deal. And then what it would do is it would do like a stale while revalidate essentially in Redis for us. And I wrote this by hand. And the big problem is Prisma didn't expose the right types that we needed to really get a good handle on this. So that, let's say if I passed a find many arguments into this thing and a find many, or I've passed in a find one arguments and a find one, like some of those types are just really complex and annoying, just straight up annoying to write. So, hey, I know the caching mechanism works. I can toss an any on that, or I can just leave it as an error for now and come back to it later. If I want to spend a day writing these types, like sometimes that happens, even if, you know, I'm experienced. Wes is very experienced in TypeScript. Let me tell you, Wes is so experienced in TypeScript that he's writing a really detailed course on it. We just did an episode of Stumped where we were quizzing each other on TypeScript stuff. The man knows his stuff. And I'll tell you what, if you do a command find in the syntax code base, in fact, I'm going to do this right this second. I bet I could find some casting or some any or something. And I don't know if he wrote it. Maybe I wrote it.
Can't blame it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be able to find something where you could say this is like a patch on top of something, you know, just because that's just the way it is working in TypeScript sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can just add to that, like one of the experiences I had actually starting from scratch is just doing like a slow port. So I have several code bases that it's kind of just a mess of like copy pasted code. Like it works for what I need to, but I was trying to like more modernize that code base. And one thing I'm doing is just converting it to a monorepo one project at a time, and in the process, converting it to TypeScript, like one project and one file at a time. So I'll add a new package to the monorepo. I'll start to port over the code, but anytime it's like not using TypeScript or it didn't have the exact right types, I'll spend the time making it work and making it nice and pretty and using all the types that I can. I realize that not everyone has that luxury, right? You can't always start from scratch. You can't always just like port everything over piecemeal, but it's a personal project. So I think it depends on the size of the project. It depends on your scenario, but there's definitely a lot of ways to approach it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one of those things. You kind of just got to go for it and you will learn lessons along the way. And if you ever have to do it again, you're going to be way better at it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. How many times do you get that opportunity? Okay. Next question here from Tim Wrinkle. Tim says, I am working on a couple of countdown apps. One is a single timer. The other is multiple timers with a common start and different end times. One scenario is short term, like 15 minutes. The other is a countdown to Christmas sort of thing. My question is, of performance and accuracy. Assuming the timers update once per second using set interval, is it better to establish the base time using new date or whatever and just keep subtracting 1 second from that or do a new date every second? This is a fun problem. Once you get into set interval and set timeout, sometimes it can feel like a little rough. I have done some timers and stuff, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say, CJ.
Sure. Yeah. So I've the way that I've approached it, and again, this is just my approach. I think the other thing about this is like what Tim has described, it'll probably work. I think it, when it comes down to accuracy, that's might be where there are some kind of like holes in the plan. But let me tell you, I guess, how I would implement it. And in some things about set interval and set timeout, because what you may not realize is that with set interval and set timeout, let's say you pass in 500 milliseconds, that's only a minimum guarantee of when the function will be called again. It's not that this function will be called in exactly 500 milliseconds. So that's where you lose that accuracy. If you're saying set interval with 1,000 milliseconds, it's at a minimum 1,000 milliseconds, but it might be 1,100 milliseconds or something like that. It all depends on like what's happening in your JavaScript codes. So that's important to note if you're using something like set interval or set timeout. And so my advice is don't actually use either of those things. Basically, the state or the source of truth here is potentially the start and end time of each of your timers, right? So you might have a start time that you set as like the date when that specific timer started. And then you maybe have another property that's like duration, total duration in milliseconds. And so that's like kind of like your source of truth. And then now it's completely accurate because no matter how often a set interval or a set timeout runs, you can always do the maths to figure out when should that timer actually end. So yeah, keep your state that way, like have a start time or an end time or a timer duration in milliseconds. And then you also just have a single tick function. So the idea with this is it gets called once every 100 milliseconds or once every 200 milliseconds. And that looks at the state of all of your timers. The other idea with implementing it this way is you have way less things to manage, right? So let's say you have like 10 timers and they were all using set interval. Now you have 10 different functions that are all potentially firing off at different times. But if you have a single tick function that kind of like looks through your state of timers and determines, all right, when did that timer start? When is it supposed to end? And then like update your state accordingly. That's going to be much easier to manage. And the other thought with that is actually don't use a set interval for that. Just use a set timeout. So you set timeout in 200 milliseconds. Your tick function runs. It looks through your state to determine which timers are done, how much time does each timer have left, and then it calls itself in 200 milliseconds with a set timeout.
Yeah, it's funny. As we were talking, I went and looked up the last time I wrote a stopwatch. Was for a dance application. I worked on an application to help me practice dancing. And one of the things I had was that every 30 seconds, a club air horn would sound. And the reason that is because typically breakdancers, when we do our routines or our sets, they're like 30 seconds to 40 seconds. And that feels like a lot of time when you're doing it because it's really high endurance. So the way that I would train was like every 30 seconds, I would know there's an air horn. So I would do 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off as a way of training my endurance. So I wrote this code and I'm looking at this code and I'll tell you, this is how you know how old this is. It is One, it's using an auto-bind decorator. Its export default class extends pure component. So it used pure component from React, which way back in the day, that's what we had to do. And a component will unmount. And I haven't seen this style of React code in a little while. I kind of miss it. I don't have too much to add there. I was pleasantly surprised to see that the approach I took that long ago was exactly what you were talking about. I have a tick function. Yeah, doing the same stuff. So, hey, nice CJ.
This next question comes from LA Drinker. And their question is, are you listening to podcasts? Which ones? So first up, Syntax. I listen to Syntax.
Hey, yeah, me too.
Listen to Syntax before I worked here and now that I do as well. But I like some of the podcasts that come from WNYC. So there's This American Life and Radiolab. I'll almost always just download some of those episodes if I'm going on like a flight or like a long drive or something like that. This American Life is literally just like slice of life stories. Radiolab, also kind of like slice of life, but they do a lot of audio production. So there's like really interesting like music they'll add that kind of like it adds to the audio storytelling element. And then I like a podcast called Darknet Diaries. Have you ever listened?
Yeah. In fact, Jack Reciter did one of our spooky stories a couple of Halloweens ago for us.
I missed that one.
Yeah, so we're kind of tight.
Nice.
He was featured on Syntax once, so we're tight.
But yeah, that one's, so if you haven't heard of it, it's all about like hacking and everything involved with hacking. Not only like cybersecurity, but also like physical penetration testing. And so he'll get guests, Jack will get guests on there that will kind of like describe and talk about their stories and exploits of like breaking into buildings like legally because they were hired to do so. And then also just general like hacking stories. So yeah, that one's super entertaining. I also listen to Song Exploder. I haven't listened more recently, but this one's cool because they will get the actual musicians and producers for songs and then kind of break down what actually happened in the song. And there was actually a Netflix series that launched that was like a companion to the audio podcast, but the audio podcast is really cool. And then a couple more. I listened to a podcast called Ear Biscuits. It's from Rhett and Link, some of like the OG YouTubers. And their tagline is two lifelong friends talk about life for a long time. So it's literally just them talking about random things. But I'm a big fan of the Good Mythical Morning. So I enjoy that. And then the last one is WTF with Mark Maron. So I started listening a long time ago and I also like watched Mark's TV show, but he's a comedian and he just interviews people. I think it started off with just interviewing comedians. And I think one of the episodes that really sold me on it was his interview with Tim Heidecker from the Tim and Eric comedy duo. And that one resonated because like Tim is almost always in character, like no matter what he's doing, it's like, you can't tell, like, is he being serious? Is he not? But that specific episode on Mark Maron, like I actually saw him as a real person. And like, he gave like a really good interview to like, really, just like who is Tim and stuff like that. So yeah, those are some of my favorites.
Nice. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I don't listen to too many of those, but I have, you know, I listened to Radiolab for a long time. Darknet Diaries, I do listen to. Every time I listen to Song Exploder, I really like it, but it's like one of those ones that I didn't, it's not part of my regular flow, but I just really enjoy it. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I'm going to list some of them. I'm going to put a word of warning. My comedy podcasts are fairly crass. If you are not into juvenile crass humor, do not listen to these. Action Boys is one. It's three comedians are talking about action movies from the 80s and 90s. Big fan of that. They are very funny. The episodes typically last a long time. E1 is a comedy podcast where every single episode is the first episode of a podcast. So they'll be like Science Guys, the Science Guys podcast. And then they're improving on these characters that they make as being like, here's, you know, three scientists who have started a podcast and they get absurd. They're very funny. Your Kickstarter Sucks is extremely crass. Do not listen to that one with your kids in the cars. It's about Kickstarters who are bad Kickstarters, really. But it's much more than that. They probably spend 30 minutes of each episode just making rude humor jokes. Fitness podcasts, I listen to Stronger by Science and Data Driven Strength. They basically are in-depth, very scientific podcasts about working out, just going over journals and all sorts of stuff from actual trained scientists. Film podcasts, I Was There Too, Pure Cinema, Video Archives, You Must Remember This is really good. History and Crime. I'm listening right now to The Spy Who, and it's about a guy who debatably was the inspiration for James Bond. This podcast is trying to like claim that he was the inspiration, but that connection is tenuous. Either way, it's an interesting podcast for spy stories. DNA ID is all about how they're using DNA modernly to solve crimes. It's a little gruesome. Swindled is up in the range of like Darknet Diaries. Swindled is a really good one. It's about hucksters and all sorts of stuff. Very Darknet Diaries-esque.
Nice.
Tech podcast, The Automators. Localfirst.fm is a new podcast I listen to about Local First software. The Privacy Files. Music podcast I listen to. What Had Happened Was. It's like interviews of rap musicians' careers over the course of their careers. Past guests have been Prince Paul, LP, Questlove. It's really good. Miscellaneous Tales of Taboo. I've sick picked that one before. It's a woman reading anonymous stories from people who have, you know, I worked as a housekeeper for wealthy people and stuff like that. Mm. So like just interesting stories. ADHD Rewired. It's good for me. I learn a lot. And then Search Engine for kind of generic stories. One of the ones I recently listened to, Where Did All the Cockroaches Go? And it was talking about how in the 80s and 70s, there were cockroaches everywhere. Like what happened to that? Well, where did that, you know, where did that go? And it was pretty interesting. So yeah, that was long-winded. There's a lot of podcasts I like in there. You might be able to find something that you enjoy. I've sick picked a massive amount of these in the past. So
yeah. Didn't you have like your Spotify Wrapped? Was it your Spotify Wrapped or like, didn't like you listen to an insane number of hours last year?
Disgusting. Yeah. It's actually embarrassing. Yes. It's very embarrassing.
Okay.
And the majority of those were actually podcasts I did not even list in this list because they're hockey podcasts. So I spared you all my hockey podcast list, of which I'm currently angry because my team is doing poorly. So next question from Tim Smith. With AI on the rise, do you think free tier plans will become a thing of the past, or do you feel that GPU compute will get cheap enough for free tiers? It says to remail, but I don't know if that's the correct word that he's trying to say. I think that crypto killed the free plans a long time ago. You know, when was the last time you saw like a free node plan somewhere? You know, yeah, I don't think they're coming back, the free plans. You know, I think that was a time and a place. It was my favorite way to learn Meteor was that Meteor had like Meteor Up, or I think it's Meteor Up, either way, Meteor Deploy or something. So that was like, you could try it out and deploy it right away. I can't imagine anybody doing that nowadays, given how you could just load up a crypto miner or something like that. Those folks are ravenous. I had like one minor security thing in my AWS account that I wasn't even using, and somebody spun up like 100 servers overnight and charged me, you know, $24,000. So I didn't have to pay it. AWS came through. I shut it down in a timely manner, and AWS removed the charge. But nice. Man, I think they're gone.
Yeah, I think anytime you give away something for free, people are going to take advantage of it. And I think like that's like it kind of started, I guess it was last year or end of year before that, where Heroku removed their free plan. And one of the biggest things they talked about was just spammers spinning up servers for like phishing schemes and stuff like that. And yeah, if you offer things for free, people are definitely going to take advantage of it. So I think you're probably going to see a shift into some more of the free tiers with sites like Render and Fly.io. They offer like a base of like $5 free per month, but you still need a credit card to sign up, and you can like set alerts so that if you go over that specific amount of limit, then they won't charge you or they will charge you. But ultimately, they're just trying to make sure that like you're a real human with a credit card and not just trying to like use their services for free.
Yeah. And I'm going to plug a Syntax episode, the host your own platform as a service, because we recently dove into some of this, and you can host a ton of things on your own servers. I mean, not necessarily your like own your own virtual private server that you can rent from anywhere. And toss Coolify on there. It's a self-hosting platform similar to Heroku or Netlify or Vercel, right? Doesn't do the serverless kind of stuff, but you can connect to GitHub repo, get a site online with an SSL certificate, and you can do that for, you know, a ton of side projects on a small server if they're not getting hit. So instead of having to pay per application that you're deploying to something like Render, you can do a whole bunch of stuff on one virtual private server. And actually, CJ, I have in about 2 hours a Mac Mini arriving that I'm going to be using to host things out of my office. So I'm getting into actual self-hosting here from a Mac Mini. So I'll have to do an episode to update us all on that.
Yeah, that'd be great. I started like a whole little, like a home lab.
Yeah.
Like I bought like, I mean, I researched like actually putting servers in your house, but anyone considering doing this, do the research because you can watch YouTube videos of how loud they are. You do not want a server like sitting in your office because it'll just be spinning fans all the time.
That's why I went Mac Mini route or ARM. So what I'm doing is I have mini, I have a few Raspberry Pis and I have a Mac Mini. So I'm going all ARM here and I'm not doing the classic home lab Linux server deal. I've done some of that research, but yeah, it's a wild world, the home lab stuff. In fact, let me show you this.
Yeah. Nice.
My rack mounted power strip just arrived yesterday for my ARM home lab. So
sweet.
Yeah, I couldn't get that excited about a rack mounted power strip.
All right, this next question comes from Spike. And the question is, what is SemVer anyways, which is short for semantic versioning? And they had a really long story I'm going to summarize. And honestly, the story might even be good for like one of the spooky Halloween episodes because it's about upgrading when they shouldn't have. But the TLDR is they wanted to use jQuery version 3 features. So they just upgraded without realizing that some downstream site was actually dependent on jQuery v2. Clients got really mad. They started reaching out. Why is everything broke? And then they just downgraded back to V2. So I'll dive in really quick just to talk about what SemVer is. If you want to learn more, semver.org has a great explanation of what this is, but you've probably seen it before. So if you're installing a package from NPM, it's always going to have a 3-dot number. So that's the major number, dot the minor number, dot the patch number. The current version of React is 18.2.0. And so 18 is the major version. 2 is the minor version, and 0 is the patch number. And if a project is following semantic versioning, like the React library is, that major number, that 18, if that ever goes up, that means there are breaking changes. So that's why we see the jump from like 16 to 17 to 18. React has introduced backwards incompatible changes, and they're letting you know via the version number, the major version number. The minor version number is for added functionality, so like new features that don't break things. So the next version here, if React adds new features, would be 18.3 instead of 18.2. And then that last number is for patches and bug fixes. So if there's maybe not a new feature, but they fixed a bug, they would bump that to 18.2.1. And there's other stuff to learn about this, like pre-release and like alpha and different things like that. But when you see a version number like that, it's very likely that the project is using semantic versioning. You should note, though, that any version number below version 1, there are no guarantees. So you can expect breaking changes at any time. And I have experience with that more recently with auth.js. So that's the project from the NextAuth team to make an auth library that will work with a lot of different backend libraries, not just Next.js. And it's still experimental. And they clearly label that on their website. So they are version 0.28.0. So they're not even version 1 yet. But each new feature, a lot of times, actually is a breaking change. And next time, it'll be like 0.3 or 0.4. So you can't always guarantee that they're following semantic versioning, but you should definitely like look at the library and see what they say in their docs. And then another interesting one is TypeScript. So TypeScript actually doesn't follow semantic versioning at all. And they have I'll link in the show notes. There's an article that describes what exactly they do. I'll give you the short version here. So a new minor version is released every 3 months with new features. And then a new major version is released if the minor version would have exceeded 9. So if they're going from 4.9 to 4.10, they actually just bump the whole version to 5. So they're actually you'll find that in TypeScript a lot of times you can upgrade from 4 to 5 and there actually aren't breaking changes, and that's because they're not actually following semantic versioning.
Yeah. Well, I really like that explanation about everything. What's funny is that I've always said, I could not tell you why this is. I've always said SemVer, and like now that you're saying SemVer, saying it like that, I'm like, obviously it's Semver. I don't know why I would have ever said Semver in the first place.
I pronounce a lot of things wrong, so maybe, no, I don't know.
No, it's semantic versioning, Semver. That makes so much more sense than Semver. I have no idea why I possibly would. And now I'm feeling embarrassed because I know I've said that on the podcast a whole bunch. Mm. In a general rule, too, if you're updating packages, typically you can update a patch version, but always test your code, make sure it works. I pretty much always YOLO update patch versions for stuff and then just make sure everything's working afterwards. I'll update, you know, 10 or so different, it's a bad practice, but I'll update like 10 or so different packages to their patch versions at once, typically because it doesn't break anything, but you know, yeah, you never can be sure. You always got to test it. Next question here from Adam Marsala. I have a question about your home office environment. Do you have any general specific recommendations of how to create a productive but also relaxed workspace for thinking clearly and staying comfortable and focused? I've been working from home as a web developer for 2 years now, and I'm still using a room in our house that was once used for a kid's room, judging by the cloud wallpaper. Oh, that's straight out of Toy Story. Cloud wallpaper. It has never felt like my own space. Instead, it just feels like a space I am borrowing for the time being. It's full of clutter, as well as my partner and I are sharing the office for storage, which doesn't help. I'm wondering if either of you have any experience or ever come across any interior design related tips to make a home office feel more like a home office that keeps you productive and happy. A funny but embarrassing side note, I was in a meeting the other day and someone saw the cloud wallpaper in my background and they said that, or they thought I was just really into Salesforce. Classic. What makes your home office feel good to you? For me, clean air, clean desk, no junk, lights and headphones is a big one for me. I have a air purifier over here just to, you know, cycle through the air, but I also open the windows as much as possible. If you got windows, that's a good thing to do. Get some fresh air in there. You know, if you have the opportunity to put windows or lights or whatever, yes, do that. You know, some whiter bulbs rather than oranger bulbs will definitely give you more of a work feel. It will keep you more focused and less relaxed necessarily. Those are some just kind of general things, but you know, I think the big things are, is that you have a clean workspace more so than like, yeah, sure. I have my Kung Fu movie posters over here and I have, like some art over there that I did and stuff like that. And like those things, absolutely. Paint. If you can get rid of that cloud wallpaper, man, do it. Like, just spend the weekend and do it. Paint it how you want it to look and throw some art up on the wall. But the things that are most important to me is that my desk is at least clean at the beginning of the week. As the week goes on, it's Tuesday. My desk is already not clean, but Monday it was clean. I'll tell you that. Those are some big things for me. As long as I'm not knocking stuff over when I'm trying to sit here and be productive, or I can stand and move around, you have that space. But also you can pull yourself into a more enclosed environment by putting on headphones and by doing those types of things that can get you more connected to what you're working on. But those are for me. What do you think, CJ?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I try to keep my workspace clean. That's probably the thing I'm worst about, but I always know, like, I'm way less productive when I'm like tripping over stuff or like when things are super cluttered. So I always, at least once a week, I'll spend some time just like tidying up. I recommend calming decorations, you know, like you can do greenery, plants, anything that, I mean, makes your space feel more comfortable and relaxing. I completely agree with lighting. So like if you have a window and you can do natural lighting, that's probably the best way to go because of our circadian rhythm and like actually seeing real sunlight when you're working during the day. But if you can't, you should look into lights that allow you to adjust the color temperature. So I actually have two lights here and they can go all the way from like a really low, like 2000K all the way up to like 6500K. And daylight is like a much higher K value. And so if you can find adjustable lights, that's another cool thing. Yeah. And then I would recommend if you can't paint or you can't do wallpaper, just use curtains. There's actually like a little behind the scenes. There's no wall behind those yellow curtains there.
No way.
They're just, and for the audio listeners, I have yellow curtains like way behind me, behind all my stuff that I have hung up. But I'm in like a big basement space. So I kind of like section things off with curtains basically. So yeah, it's super easy. It's not permanent. And if you want it to be permanent, you can like attach a curtain rod to the wall or to the ceiling or whatever else. But you could also look into photography backdrop stands. So like a lot of what people in like film and TV do with like set design is they literally will just put up a stand and make it appear like there's a window behind some curtains or something like that. And then I think to your point of like being a little bit embarrassed about the cloud background, honestly, I guess you could be a little bit vain about it and like kind of just focus on your back, especially if you're on camera a lot, focus on what people can see in your background. Because if for you, people, if you feel like you're getting, I guess, better vibes or better impressions from people that are you're with on video chat a lot, that might also help with your own ideas of your workspace. So yeah, like try to make an interesting backdrop or at least a calm one. It's a lot better than just like a beige wall or like a stack of boxes or something like that.
Yeah. And my to go off of that, my office here, like you're saying, it looks nice behind me. But if I were to turn this camera around, one of my pictures fell off the wall. I got a monitor on the floor. I got lights over here. And like, yeah, I pick up, you know, I do it once a week. But yeah, I worry about the stuff behind me more than the stuff in front of me. That's for
exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. And then I have a couple of notes because I think I read at the beginning of their question, they were kind of, I kind of interpreted it as like trying to find a workspace at home, but mainly they're talking about like interior design. But I will say for anybody that is new to working from home, definitely have a dedicated space for that. So like when the pandemic hit and I was working from home more often, I did all my work from the couch and that was not good. Like it was very hard to like shut off my work brain at 5 p.m. Also, I developed wrist issues because I was using the trackpad on the couch all the time.
Yeah.
So if you have the luxury of separate spaces, use them. So like I actually have a separate home office from my like work office. So like end of the day here, I can walk and then it's almost like a mental thing to like go into a different room and like now you're not working anymore. I'm working on side projects and stuff like that. Or like if you're in the living room, it shouldn't feel like you're at work.
Yeah. Separating those environments is key. When we bought our most recent house here, it has an office attached to the garage because in Denver, you often have like garages in the alley. And so when we were looking at houses, I don't know if the guy who owned this house before was like an accountant or something. So he finished this space that was attached to the garage. And when I saw it, I was like, this is the perfect work from home environment because specifically, yeah, you can really say, I got a door. I can walk out that door and go to my house. It feels like I'm truly going to work. I know that's obviously a luxury for me here, but like, yeah, just separating those spaces is so key. And your note about the couch, check this out. I'm going to get off mic here for a second and just move my camera around.
Cool.
A little behind the scenes. I got a dog and a couch.
Nice.
Yeah, there's some mess over here. Yeah. Sorry, y'all, if that was nauseating. But I put a couch in my office, and let me tell you, it does not fit in here well. It's a cheap old IKEA couch that we've had for like 15 years at this point. And my wife was like, let's get rid of this thing. And I was like, not so fast. I'm going to shove it in my tiny little office here so that way I can have a couch if I need to just lay down and think.
Nice. Yeah. Next question comes from Mr. JavaScript. And he says, hey, Scott and Wes, but actually, hey Scott and CJ, do you ever stop to consider Vue.js in 2024? Why or why not? Do you like movies with gladiators? On the gladiator point, I guess I don't watch a lot of gladiator movies. But I've been using Vue.js for a very long time. And I exclusively, like really before Svelte really took off, I would almost always choose Vue.js for side projects. And I also ran the Denver Vue.js meetup here. So yeah, I have a long love for Vue, but these days I am reaching for Svelte more because I think one of the reasons that I liked Vue so much is that it got rid of a lot of the boilerplate of React. It made it so easy to like build things without a bunch of boilerplate. You can mutate state, which actually I'm a really big fan of, instead of like having to work with mutable state. But these days, like I would say in 2024, if I were to choose Vue, it probably would be because of Nuxt, because Nuxt is also doing some really cool things. And that's the competitor or the compare. You can compare it to like SvelteKit or Next.js, but for Vue. But their dev experience is pretty awesome. I tried it about a year ago, like right when version 3 was released, and it was still early days just because V3 had just come out. But it's about the time I should try it again, because it's the ecosystem has definitely matured a lot more. And then on the last point, Vue is also still doing cool things. So Vue 3 Vapor was announced like a few months back, but I think it might have been released more recently. It is basically like a compiler for your Vue components. So there's definitely been a push in the web development world and front end to have like more performant front end codes. And Vapor mode basically allows you to opt in so that you can get components that aren't actually using the virtual DOM and have basically been optimized ahead of time. And so that's a cool thing they're doing that kind of gets them in line with the cool stuff that like Svelte is doing, or even like Solid.js.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I'm in the Vue.js documentary, the Honeypot one. So I definitely have a history with Vue. And, you know, I really like working in Vue. Very similarly to you, I picked up Vue because, you know, it was a step in the more comfortable direction for me away from React. I worked in React for a long time, but before that I came from Blaze, which is what Meteor's framework is. And Blaze, Evan actually worked on Blaze for a little bit. So it was very similar to Vue in a lot of ways. And so when Vue came out, I was like, this feels way more at home for me compared to what I was dealing in React. But very similar to you, Svelte to me took that the next step. And because Svelte took it in the next step, it's like I didn't need that middle ground option. And I am opting for Svelte just about 100% of the time nowadays. So for me, I'm in the Svelte world, and React is like on the one end of it can do a lot, but you have to do a lot. And Vue is in the other end of it can do a lot, but you have to do little. And Vue is kind of right there in the middle. And for me, like, that's why I'm not picking it. It's great. If you're a Vue developer, awesome. It's a great platform. And people often ask why we don't talk about it on the show. And I think it's mostly just because we're not working in it frequently. But I really do love Vue. Have you checked out unjs.io, CJ?
I have. So most of what I know about it is it's what's powering Nuxt.
Yeah.
And I gave it a try when I was like looking at various like backend frameworks, because like it can kind of do similar stuff to like Hono and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yes, you're dead on with all of that. And I did the exact same thing. I looked at it and I was like, huh. And I gave it a try. It's fine. There's some cool stuff. They just announced some interesting, you know, easy to add WebSockets, all kinds of little things in their Nitro platform. There's a lot of stuff here. And when you go to this UnJS website, you're like, if you haven't used this before, you might be thinking, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff here. And there really is. It does a lot for you. So definitely something to check out. Anything else on the Vue subject while we're here, CJ? Or do you want to get into sick picks and shameless plugs?
I think that's all I got. Let's jump into sick picks.
Cool. I have a sick pick today. I actually have one ready. It's a yogurt. I'm bringing yogurt to the show. And I'm going to preface this, but this is a bougie-ass yogurt. This is expensive. But my wife has been getting it from Whole Foods lately, and it's Elanos, I think that's how you say it, and it's some Seattle-based yogurt. And my gosh, it is the best. It's so good. And I did not know it was expensive, and I told Courtney, I said, please, only buy Elanos and buy tons of it. And she's like, that'll bankrupt us. That's not going to happen. So it's a little treat. It's lovely. But if you're a yogurt person, give it a try, man. It's Greek yogurt. So high protein, all that good stuff, fruit in the bottom. Very, very good. Super yummy. You can find it at Whole Foods. I'm thinking about calling up my local Costco and telling them, what do we have to do to get this in bulk here?
Nice. For me, I also am picking a food, and I have a visual guide. So
nice.
I like spicy food, and I recently discovered pepper flakes from Flatiron Pepper Co. And so the thing about this is, like, I never thought that pepper flakes could like actually have flavor. For me, it was also always like, add some pepper flakes, make it a little more spicy.
Yeah.
But this changed everything. Like, so I especially like the green, the Hatch Valley green. Pepper flakes.
That's very Colorado of you.
Well, it's Flatiron Pepper Co. So they're a Colorado company. But you can find it like on Amazon. I think they're in a lot of like major grocery stores too. But yeah, if you like spicy foods, it's super awesome. Especially like for me, I was using hot sauce on a lot of things, but it's fun to switch it up every now and then use some pepper flakes instead.
I'm going to check this out. I was making a little spicy oil yesterday, and the pepper flakes we had, not a huge fan, didn't really love it. And I was thinking, I gotta get some new pepper flakes. So this is really timely for me, CJ.
Nice. Yeah, my wife got me the three pack for Christmas. So they have like a smoky one, like a traditional red, and then like a green one too. Yeah.
Did she get it from the Savory Spice Shop?
I don't know.
Maybe. Have you ever been to the Savory Spice Shop?
I haven't.
Okay. There is a savory spice shop, which this, the Savory, that's the name of it, is the Savory Spice Shop. And they have these in a few cities. I know they're across, but one of the big stores is in Denver, and it's right by, man, it's by the bridge that goes from the Highlands to Lodo, that little bridge. Yeah. And what else is over there? The REI flagship store is right over there. So it's like right across the street from that. That place rules. If you're into spices and you're in the Denver area, check out the Savory Spice Shop. Shout out to them. They're fantastic. I think there's one in Chicago and stuff too. So yeah. Shameless plugs. I'm going to plug the Syntax YouTube channel. And I gotta say, CJ just released a couple of videos and they're fantastic. So if you've been liking CJ on the show, head on over to at Syntax FM on YouTube. We'll have a link in the show notes. We're posting the podcast in visual manner there. If you want to see me tilt my camera and show my dog on the couch, that's on there. Check it out. Syntax on YouTube. We're doing a lot of fun stuff and it's only going to get better over there.
Nice. I'm just going to pick the same. Is it okay if we shameless plug the same thing?
It's more than okay.
Great. Yeah. YouTube, YouTube.com/@SyntaxFM. Subscribe, please. And check out my videos because it's been fun making them. And check out YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. Check out YouTube. Cool. Well, this has been awesome. I hope you had a lot of fun, CJ. And that's all I got. Peace.
Later.